This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker.
Caitlin Flanagan begins her latest cover story in the Atlantic magazine with a scene that could have come from the 1978 movie Animal House.
It's the story of a West Virginia fraternity brother named Travis Hughes. One warm spring night, about 3 years ago, Travis decided to shove a bottle rocket up a sensitive area of his body and light the fuse.
Yeah, good times. But the adventure did not end well for Hughes or for another student who was recording the event with his cell phone. After detonation, he stumbled away in apparent shock and fell off the deck and seriously injured himself. Soon, lawyers were involved.
Needless to say, this and many other scenes that Flanagan writes about involve alcohol. Lots and lots of it. Too much alcohol is just one aspect of what Flanagan calls a dark and violent history of fraternities in the U.S. Other aspects include assault and battery, violent hazing, as well as sexual assault.
Her year-long reporting project also describes a sophisticated legal system that shifts blame from the national fraternity organizations to the students themselves. And she joins us now to talk more about her expose on fraternities. And Kate Flanagan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really good to have you. And I should tell our listeners you're talking to us now from Los Angeles. That opening scene about Travis Hughes, it's almost comical, but you quickly get to the more serious point about fraternities when you write, for every butt bomb, there's a complaint of manslaughter, rape, sexual torture, psychological trauma. So given that, why is the Greek system still thriving on so many campuses today?
Well, you have to remember that the fraternity system is deeply woven, not just into contemporary college life, but into the very history of higher education in the United States. In a sense, you could say it's even older than the United States. It grew out of Freemasonry, and George Washington himself was a Freemason. And when the system as we know it, the current system, which is a 19th century system, began, there were only 4,600 college students in all of the United States. So when they started adopting the fraternity system, they were at the very beginning of higher education in America, and it's grown and kept pace. And the colleges and universities, much as they're bedeviled by the fraternities, they're also deeply dependent on the fraternities. So to say, as people often will, college presidents should shut them down, colleges should get rid of them, it's a far more complex situation than that.
And I want to talk about that, because I know your article is very serious, really well investigated. But let me play a clip from a movie just to sort of put this whole discussion in a kind of historical context. So we read today that Harold Ramis died. Now, for listeners who don't know, star of Ghostbusters, he also wrote National Lampoon's Animal House. And so the party house image of frats is nothing new here. And here's a scene from that famous movie when the Deltas defend their bad behavior at a trial before the school administration.
The issue here is not whether we broke a few rules or took a few liberties with our female party guests. We did. But you can't hold a whole fraternity responsible for the behavior of a few sick, perverted individuals. For if you do, then shouldn't we blame the whole fraternity system? And if the whole fraternity system is guilty, then isn't this an indictment of our educational institutions in general? Isn't this an indictment of our entire American society?
So, Caitlin, I think when I saw that movie, I took the whole thing as sort of a spoof and a joke. But as I read your article, the sentiment expressed in that quote seems to be sort of alive and well today.
Very much so. And you have to remember, Animal House is very instrumental in our current fraternity scene. When the movie came out, fraternities were kind of dead. It was the late 70s. The Cultural Revolution of the 60s and early 70s had made fraternity membership the most reactionary thing you could ever do. And chapters had closed by the hundreds. But with that movie, there was suddenly a new interest in this life. And as we moved into the early 80s, and it was the Reagan years, there was this whole new interest in that kind of conservative, traditional lifestyle that had really been sort of diminished in college life. And so Animal House is really a key sort of cultural moment. And I think it got a lot of that. What's depicted in Animal House is so mild compared to what we see today in fraternities, but it's still kind of a key point of observation about the history of fraternities in America.
Well, you write about a lot of the problems, and one of the issues that you investigated, it comes up early in your piece, is how many fraternity brothers and sisters and their guests get drunk And this almost sounds trivial, but you point out it's not. Get drunk and end up falling off of or out of fraternity houses. So tell us a case in point. 19-year-old Amanda Andaverde, who joined Delta mm-hmm. Delta Delta at the University of Idaho. What happened to her?
Well, the larger issue there was that I kept coming across what I thought were strange and I assuredly had to be singular kinds of injuries, you know, and I would think that's got to be a weird one-of-a-kind thing, mm-hmm. such as butt chugging at the University of Tennessee. And then I found lots of incidents of damaged rectums from butt chugging. I found that kids fall off these fraternity houses all the time. It started with looking into the case of Amanda Andaverde, who went to a fraternity party, got drunk, went upstairs and lay down in a bed with one of the fraternity brothers. And in rolling over on this bunk bed, she fell through the open window three floors and landed on the cement afterwards and is brain damaged to this day because of that fall, permanent brain damage. And when I was reading through the legal filings around that case, I saw that 2 weeks before she fell, another kid had fallen at the very same campus from a fraternity house. And I thought, let me just study over a 12-month period how many kids fall from fraternity houses. We came up with 21 serious falls that are going through to, you know, there's death, there's paralysis, there's serious disfigurement, and that's just one kind of injury that happens, and they all are linked, obviously, through alcohol.
Right. And then the very tricky question of liability comes into play, because in all of these cases, or most of these cases, lead to lawsuits. What kind of responsibility do the fraternities end up having to take on because of injuries like this?
Well, my basic sort of tactic in reporting the story was to always follow the money. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know every aspect of the money that goes into fraternities. Where do all the money for the dues go to? How much money do the fraternities own? And how much public dollars go into supporting them? The answers to all of these things were shocking to me. But first place, when someone's injured at a fraternity, the lawyers, unless they're really savvy, always try to sue the university or the college, and that goes nowhere. The university and the college in the modern era, we no longer have in loco parentis. What the student does on his or her free time outside of the classroom is not supervised by the college. So falling and being very injured in the fraternity house legally isn't very different from falling and being seriously injured at the 7-Eleven. It's private property. It's a private society. Student went there of his or her own free will. So the college is off the hook.
Hmm. Now, so how do the fraternities, how do they protect themselves, the fraternities?
What they've done is a very complicated system of self-insurance whereby if a fraternity member makes any mistake, even a small mistake, having one beer if he's under 21, for example, and some hideous thing place in the fraternity house, that fraternity member, if he's named as a defendant, will be instantly dropped from the fraternity insurance that he paid for because he broke their risk management policy. He'll be probably dropped from the fraternity itself, and any damages against him end up getting paid by mom and dad's homeowner's insurance. And mom and dad also have to pay for his legal defense because obviously there's no public defendants in civil litigation. So these kids sign all these papers when they're 18 years old, probably the first time they've signed binding documents without their mother and father beside them. And mom and dad sort of assume that anything that happens, he'll be an adult, it'll be on his shoulders. No, it goes right to his planning for retirement parents. So that's a very significant aspect of joining a fraternity.
Yeah, in fact, you say, you write that parents of students, and you warn them as you write this, you say, parents, sit down before you read this next paragraph. And basically your point is they can be held responsible for their kids' behavior at fraternities.
Exactly, because kids' legal address in college, kids don't change their legal address every time they move from dorm to dorm and apartment to apartment. Their car is registered, their voter registration, everything through their parents' home address, and that gets tied quickly back to the umbrella policy the parents hold.
You write that fraternities have a long, dark history of violence against their own members and visitors to their houses, which makes them in many respects at odds with the core mission of the college itself. It's a really strong indictment. And why do so many colleges then allow fraternities to remain? I mean, what is the relationship, the benefit, I guess, that colleges derive from fraternities?
1 in 8 students in the United States of America who's a college student lives in fraternity housing, in Greek housing. 1 in 8. Fraternities are the single largest owner of student accommodation and residences. That's a tremendous amount of accommodations that colleges don't have to pay for, they don't have to maintain, they don't have to insure, and they can tell prospective students, and kids want some kind of an on-campus experience, that even though we don't have enough dorm space for you, you can be accommodated through Greek housing. Furthermore, fraternity men give a tremendous amount of money to their colleges and universities. They remain strongly tied to their institutions in ways that non-Greek members sometimes aren't tied to their institutions. And when you think about it this way, if, you know, if John Smith wasn't in a fraternity and he goes back to relive his college days, what's he going to do? Go back to his old dorm and ask the kid in the room if he can sit and have a beer with him? That would be creepy. He's always welcome back at the frat. There's always a beer for him. There's always kids who want to hear his war stories. He always feels 19 again. And that kind of emotional bonding back to your institution, development and advancement offices are very savvy how to capitalize on that.
Listeners, we're talking to Caitlin Flanagan. She's a journalist. Her cover story in the current issue of The Atlantic is called The Dark Power of Fraternities. You can find a link to that at our website. We'd like to hear from you. Were you in a fraternity? Do you see the good in the fraternities, the bad in fraternities? What do you think? What do you make of Caitlin Flanagan's thesis here? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. One thing I wanted to ask you, Caitlin. Oh, actually, let me play you some tape again. We had our interns, Jamie Bologna and Anna Taylor, walk around Boston University, Northeastern University earlier today to ask students what role the Greek life plays in the social lives on their campuses. Here's what they said.
My name is Tyler Snyder. I'm a current junior here at Boston University. I have been involved with a fraternity here on campus. It would be interesting with a campus without fraternities. Though it is a small portion of the campus, I think that it accounts for a majority of the social life and community events really here on campus.
I'm Fiona McCarthy, and I'm a freshman at Northeastern University, and I'm not a member of a sorority. My experience without that sort of network has been a little bit lonelier, I'd say, than girls I've seen that have been in a sorority.
I think fraternities and sororities are important to have on campus. My name's Greg Glum. I am part of the class of 2015 at Northeastern. I think the main point of a sorority and fraternity, especially later in life, is like you do set up those connections with other people like around the nation, which is nice.
So, Caitlin Flanagan, some voices there from BU and Northeastern. You know, by and large, positive, talking about important relationships you carry into the rest of your life. What did you observe with regard to attitudes like that in the course of doing your reporting? Or how do you how do you respond to what you just heard there?
It's interesting. I took a different tack to it than you did. I didn't see it so positive. Mm-hmm. But you hear over and over again that idea that the majority of social life is run through fraternities. And there's a reason for that. They have a provision for the serving of alcohol. They are, in fact, the largest single entity to serve alcohol to underage drinkers in the United States of America, other than families.
Yeah.
So what's happened, because since the early 80s or the mid-80s, we have this universal age 21 law around drinking, which has pushed all the drinking out of supervised areas. It's pushed all the drinking out of anywhere where college employees have a role to monitor, to check IDs, et cetera. And it's pushed a tremendous amount of it into the fraternity houses. And that has led directly to a huge amount of these injuries. Now, what the last young man said is, I mean, there's a lot in my article that's about the positive aspects of fraternity membership. You can absolutely supercharge your degree with a fraternity membership. Just think about it. You might go to a college that's not known for its connections in the powerhouse fields of business or law or politics, and suddenly you have an instant connection to a nationwide network of very successful men in those areas and very real ways to plug into it. So to just simply say, don't think about joining a fraternity, I would never say that. There are many substantive advantages to belonging to a fraternity, and this is not a unilateral and a fraternity piece. And beyond that, I will share with you now, I was contacted on Friday by very senior members of the fraternity industry saying that they appreciated what was in the article,
mm-hmm.
and that they felt that there was material here that they want to get out to the country, whether or not they were trying to do damage control in that way or whether or not they were legitimate about that is interesting. But the fraternity industry itself is eager for reform.
Sure. Caitlin Flanagan, stand by. I want to at least get one call into this conversation before we run out of time. Andrea is calling from Hopkinton. Andrea, you're on the air. Hi, Andrea. Do we have you? We seem to not have Andrea. Why don't we go to Will, who's calling from Framingham. Hi, Will, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hello. Hi. I went to a school down south, and I was familiar with the University of Texas and all the stereotypical horror stories you hear of fraternities there, but I went to a smaller school, Southwestern University, and I was a member of fraternity there, and during pledgeship, we definitely had, like, you know, pranks and psychological games and, you know, whatever, but we really were averse to the physical hazing that you see in Animal House and that kind of thing, and it really, for me, it produced really strong bonds within my pledge class and within the active chapter that we use to be a more positive role model on campus.
Mm-hmm. Will, thanks so much for putting that idea on the table. And Caitlin, let me ask you about that, just picking up on Will. Some fraternities, too, I mean, dedicated to real sort of social service. I mean, I know you say that your piece isn't a blanket indictment of all fraternities, so I just wanted to put that idea out there, that some of these fraternities actually, you know, are socially minded and committed to doing good acts in the community, right?
Right. Fraternities are like a franchise operation with terrible quality control. You can get a Big Mac in Cleveland, and it's pretty much like the Big Mac at San Diego. Mm. But you can go to a Sigma Chi on one campus, and they're running an extraordinary program of service, mentorship, and leadership. And anyone would want his or her son to belong to that chapter of Sigma Chi. You can go to the next campus 10 miles away, and you've got a bunch of thugs who are perpetrating essentially criminal activities. So even though they all have the same trademarked logos and carefully protected brands, they can be hugely different one to the next. And that's another one of the big problems.
Another sign of their power, and we only have about 45 seconds left, Caitlin, but I wanted to get this question in. I went to a college in New England in the 70s that had a pretty vibrant Greek system. I thought it was awful. Full disclosure, I joined it. I hated it. This college has since done away with its Greek system, much to my relief. How difficult is that for a school to make that decision, to shut it down?
The colleges will shut them down, but they'll come back. I probably guess where you went to college, and I'd be surprised if 10 years from now the frats aren't back there. They are private societies. It is very, very difficult to violate young men's constitutionally implied right of freedom of association and to say you don't have the right to belong to a private society while you're here. You can't join the Elks Club, you can't go to the Italian Society, and you can't go to a fraternity. Now, a private college can do it. A private college can legislate any kind of private behavior that it wants, and a kid is free to go or not to go. Really difficult to violate those rights of the young men.
Well, Caitlin Flanagan, it's a fascinating piece. You go into a lot of issues which we didn't have time to explore, but I'm very, very grateful for your time today. Thanks for coming on the program.
I'm grateful to you too, Anthony. Thank you.
Sure. That's Caitlin Flanagan. Her latest piece for the Atlantic Magazine is called The Dark Power of Fraternities. You can find a link to it at radioboston.org. It's a disturbing and fascinating read. And listeners, that's it for today.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.